Hello, I'm Michael.
Hello, and I'm Linda.
So, who are we? Linda is a professor of art history at University College Dublin, and at present she's teaching a course on the Grand Tour, and I'm also involved in art history as well, and I write books on art. So the two of us are passionate. We're united in our love of Italy, which is a country that we're very familiar with and we both lived in for several years. So on our last visit of the Grand Tour, this fortnightly podcast, which we're delighted that you're joining, and indeed more people are joining, and please tell your friends to like us and Spotify us or Apple us or do whatever you do on your favourite podcast platform. On this visit, we're going to go to the island of Murano. And most people are familiar with the island as the home of glassmaking. And indeed, that's what it's largely visited for now. But in its day, Murano was independent of Venice, having been founded by the Romans in the 6th century. It was so prosperous that in the 10th century, the islanders actually minted their own coins.
Well, as you were thinking about Murano, I was trying to remind myself about the term Grand Tour, actually, and in fact, just how important those islands of Murano, Burano, Torcello are when you visit Venice. And it's something episode 6, we spoke about Torcello, but in this episode, hoping to consider more about the actual making and manufacture of glass. But I'm always thinking of that magnetic allure, let's say, of Italy and that whole notion of the Grand Tour itself. And it's something that, just as an aside, it was first used as a French translation, and it was something that a Catholic priest author, Richard Lascelles, he published in 1670, A Voyage or a Complete Journey Through Italy, and he is one of the first to coin that phrase. But essentially, also Francis Bacon made reference to this notion of a grand tour, an educational trip, and something that was an indispensable experience for a young person to play a leading role in society, a way of finishing off their education. So, in fact, of course, within that, the growth of the Grand Tour in the 18th century was extraordinary, spectacular, exponential. And wrapping into that was their visits to wonder and be amazed by the glass workings at Murano. And Michael, I think you're also particularly fascinated by that, and you have an artist friend who you want to also make reference to.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's true, because most people are familiar with Venetian glass, that multicolored silicone, which is so popular with tourists. But Venetian glass has not been made in Venice for 8 centuries. And why? Well, it's quite easy to understand, because glassware was essential in the past for windows, tableware, and the Venetians were masters of the art. But there was one problem with the foundries where the glass was blown. They all needed large furnaces. And of course, when you have large furnaces, then you have fires. And when you have fires, you have laws enacted to put out the fires. In other words, you've got the oven where you make the things, but you've got to be careful that you don't set the whole place on fire. And in this case, the laws might have been a little late. In any event, in 1291, the city of Venice enacted a law requiring furnaces to move to a smaller island, and that is where we now are familiar with the island of Burano. So the little island of Murano, in reality, like Venice, is a series of tiny islands, and it became the main focus of glassmaking, and it still is today. The master glassblowers are still the oldest guild in the world, and often the tradition has been handed down from one generation to the next. So you'll find fathers passing it on to their sons and being very proud of that. And even today, when you go and look at them blowing the glass, you'll just think, my gosh, what are their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, and all the way back to Adam. But for that reason, the majority of the glass blowers are men as well. I'm not sure that we're allowed to make gender remarks anymore.
Well, what I was wondering about was that, in fact, with this interest in glass making, is this where there certainly was a centre for making the kind of gold-pressed glass cubes that we find the superb, that material in use for the glass mosaics for, say, the Cathedral of the Assumption in Torcello, or indeed in San Marco, or indeed, I think we're going to talk a little later about the mosaics at Ravenna, maybe not today, but very soon. But so it's perhaps to do with the quality of the sand from the lagoon, that wonderful, very pale and very high, I mean, there's quite a high content of, you mentioned silicone, silica, I think it is in what they need to make the glass, and I think that comes from there. So there's some wonderful chemical formula into which they have created these extraordinary works of art.
That's right, yes, and you were asking me about my artist friend, and that's Carmel Mooney, who's very well known in Ireland, has been one of our leading 20th and 21st century artists, and a while ago she was telling me about the work she's been doing, in fact, in Murano over years and years and years, and she goes over regularly to the furnaces, and she gives directions to these, because, you know, she wouldn't be able to make it herself, because you have to be, first of all, you've got to be a very strong, robust person, as I mentioned a few moments ago, but also you would need to give directions about how it's actually been made and casting. So she's actually directing all of this, and she explained how the artist can hire a furnace for a day or for a period, and some professional blowers are thrown in to order, and they execute the artist's designs. So Carmel has a number of pieces which include Sheila na Gigs and Birds in Flight, etc. But what really caught my attention was when she was explaining about all the glass which is thrown into the lagoon afterwards, because, you know, there's lots of brittle, tiny pieces which are thrown away. And she was explaining also to me about the poisonous chemicals which are used in the casting of the glass. So it's not a very clean process. And what do? They kind of, well, in the past, they just went down to the bottom of the island and they turfed their boxes and containers into the sea. Nowadays, they're supposed to take it off and have it recycled according to laws, etc. But Carmel did say she wouldn't eat any fish if she was in Venice, so that made me stop and think.
Wow, well, what a fascinating place. And if you find yourself with a spare afternoon, Murano is certainly worth the trip. But also, I mean, speaking of these different islands, something we've become very familiar with, this notion of quarantine, that was something that certainly originated in Italy, or certainly in the environ of Venice. And people have always had to isolate when they're ill, setting themselves apart from the general community. And, you know, that might be something you wanted to talk further about, Michael.
Well, yes, the bubonic plague is obviously one of the most important things, and we've just gone through our own pandemic in the world. Speaking of the islands, the concept of quarantine originated in Venice. And since time immemorial, people have isolated those who are ill, as you say, keeping them away. They don't, you know, just recently we found out that the last pandemic was an aerosol. At first we thought it was by touch or by coming in contact with surfaces. But we know that in Europe, in the middle of the 14th century, around the time of the bubonic plague, people were required at first to isolate for 30 days, so that's a month. Then a century later, in 1448, the Venetian Senate extended that period to 40 days, and that's what gives you the concept of quarantine, coming from the Latin quattro, meaning four. Dubrovnik at the time was under the influence of the Venetians, and the first lazarettos were set up in Dubrovnik. And a lazaretto comes from the Gospels and the story of Lazarus, when Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. So that's the origin of that.
Indeed. And I feel we've talked so much about epidemics and pandemics and infectious disease that I'd quite like to think about other activities on these islands. And perhaps also fascinating is the whole notion of the Jewish ghetto, which was established in Venice. And again, yeah, something that has its origins in Europe, another whole notion of segregating or separating out people from the population. And Venice has had its own history in this area, and certainly in 1516, the word ghetto is something that comes into the sources, into the texts, and it derives from the notion of the word for a copper smelting area. So curiously, we have a kind of misunderstanding of that idea, and separating people out, and, you know, this notion of confinement, in fact, is something that sets this part of Venice up apart.
Actually, in fact, to be very accurate, the Jewish people themselves asked the city authorities for their own section of the city where they'd be free to establish their synagogues and the butcher shops and other places where they prepare their food. Because, you know, they're very strict laws which are laid down in the Bible. And therefore, they wanted to have their own area where they'd be free to do this. So the Jewish people were accomplished traders, they were money changers, they could husband wealth very carefully and build houses away from the jealous eyes of some of their Christian neighbours. And remember, there was a lot of anti-Jewish feeling at that time. Just read Shakespeare's near contemporary Merchant of Venice and see how he portrays Shylock.
Yeah, so the area of the ghetto was quite small in Venice, and the increasing numbers of those settlers, of the Jewish settlers, would, you know, they had to find solution to these, to just where they were going to live. So the only way was up. So interestingly, in Venice, the houses are taller. They're somewhat taller, they're somewhat narrower than you find in other parts of the city. And I think there's a whole other area of closing over gates at midnight, and, you know, for the maybe more for the safety of people inside rather than for people keeping people out. So it's a kind of a more amicable solution to adding in a whole layer of protection.
Exactly, because the Jews then petitioned the Venetian Senate for their own district, and the Senate, although somewhat reluctantly, I'd imagine, granted them their area. And the Jewish traders were obliged to wear a yellow insignia. And of course, you're going to see that again happening during the Second World War. That's the origin of the concept of Jews having to wear a distinctive sign. And that was to distinguish them from the Christian traders.
Ah.
You see, so there's that kind of friction between them. But at the same time, there's no problem. And the Jews were quite proud of their badges. And doctors were allowed to wear a black velvet cap like Christian doctors. So that was a feather in the cap, if you like. But so successful was the ghetto that the Jews came from all over Europe to settle in Venice. Now, that might have been, I guess that might have been the reason why a little anti-Jewish sentiment developed in Venice, because they soon became more successful than the Venetians, whose families had been in the cities for centuries, long before the Jews had settled.
And I suppose an area I'm always interested in is sort of print culture and libraries and books and art, historical books and dissemination of ideas through books. And what is also fascinating about Venice is that, in fact, I think it's one third or something of books printed for the Jewish market were printed in Venice. So that's kind of an interesting idea. Setting up printing presses in Venice was something very significant. And also all that wonderful paper, that wonderful marble paper. There's still variously, Il Papiro is one of the loveliest shops you can visit when you're in Venice. While we know Johannes Gutenberg was the first to create movable typeface in the 1450s and the printing of the Bible, and that's something that really obviously takes Europe by storm by the 1530s. There's various translations being printed, but in Venice a different version of the Bible was published, and also this leaning into the kind of Jewish print market, also something they become very well known for.
That's true, yes. And Venice became a hugely important place, I suppose, a depot for printing books at the end of the 15th and into the 16th century. And as you mentioned, when you look at some of these beautiful books, I have a couple of them here beside me, with look at the gorgeous leather binding, the Moroccan binding, the gold which has been rolled into the cover, the gold, I don't know how they do this, an embossing on the side of the both the spine and also the cover itself is magnificent. And all of these were developed in Venice. And that's where you see, if you look, open here, look at the beautiful marbled fly papers on either side, how magnificent these were. These are just paints which are dribbled across the paper, and as you say, are so highly prized by the tourists and people in general who enjoy things of taste. But back to our British and Northern Europeans, to Venice in the 17th, 18th and 19th centuries. It's worth noting that bathing was not highly recommended. It was generally held that washing too often was injurious to the body. And one can only imagine the stink of the people in those days, although perhaps it's maybe wiser for us to move on to something more pleasant.
Well, indeed. I mean, it is also interesting just on this whole theme of the fear of plague and the precautions that were taken and the lazarettos before arriving, being detained in the city. In fact, you needed a bill of health, which was necessary for travel within Italy. It was known as a fede. So that was something that you had to carry with you, you know, upon your arrival into the city of Venice. So interestingly, and just coming back to our thoughts on these late 17th, 18th century visitors, travellers to the city, what Venice lacked in classical ruins, it made up for in terms of it sort of leaned into entertainment. There were so many more, you know, what were they? Theatres, the Fenice, La Fenice is the one that comes to mind. The cafes, we've thought about the, you know, the whole notion of Napoleon calling it the kind of great, I don't know, dining room or drawing room of Europe. But there was also equally an air of general air of kind of immorality. There were the gambling houses, the ridotti, the brothels. In fact, Cesare di Sita, he states that it was the English in particular, as an ancient mercantile nature in the 17th century, discovered Venice. And in a way, you know, there was a very strong link between the kind of British travellers and that, you know, the visit to Venice itself was unique. It was fascinating. It also had a kind of fame in terms of, you know, slightly discomforting in other ways. And that sense, as we've talked about, that timeless continuity. While Florence, where we hope to travel to very soon in our next, our upcoming podcast, it was very much a haven, much more home comforts, was much more sociability. Venice was much more curious. It was strange and unsettling.
There's an element of that as well. And of course, you just remind me that one of the great names associated with Venice that I'd forgotten to mention about before is Antonio Vivaldi. And Vivaldi, we're familiar with his Four Seasons, and he wrote thousands of, well, 200 or so concertos and sonatas. Although somebody said he wrote, what did they say? He wrote the same concerto 200 times because they all sound similar. But the interesting point, taking up what you were saying there, Linda, he was a priest briefly for about 15 months, and then he seems to have gone off to follow his musical career. But he was appointed as the resident composer in the Pietà, which was a house or an orphanage, if you like, for young women. And in those days, if you were an orphan, you very often stayed in the orphanage for the best part of your childhood, right into your adult life. And of course, think of those girls, they were illegitimate, or the boys. But in this case, I'm thinking of the Pietà where Vivaldi was, and they were illegitimate, so therefore they'd no dowry. And therefore, it was very difficult for them to marry off into a family. What you say is very true about the kind of the dark side. It's not all brightness and sunshine and gelato, etc.
Well, to add to that, or maybe to elevate this discussion in terms of just considering also, and to wrap up these ideas, John Ruskin is someone that we always think of when we consider Venice, and his Stones of Venice, his extraordinary series of volumes, and series of drawings and watercolours within those depict Venetian architecture in a way that, you know, it spirits us into that whole other wonderful realm. And his narrative, again, he spoke about a medieval Eden.
That's a lovely expression.
Yeah. He thought about Palladio, he felt, was someone who, and Scamozzi, Sansovino, those, they were over-sophisticated. He defined Palladio's work as being, you know, there was a mischievous effect to it. He felt that classicism didn't have a place there. His whole joy was related to this whole kind of gothicized and this medieval notion. And Eden comes to mind, or came to his mind, certainly. So, you know, this acceptance of Venice being this gallant city, the city linked to pleasure, to the Carnevale, was very much something that comes through. But equally, it held the facet, it held the sights in the eye from whether it's Torcello, whether it's the glassmaking in Murano, or indeed the wonders of travelling along that Grand Canal and looking out and seeing this wonderfully unique form of kind of Venetian Gothic, as coined by Ruskin, was something that Venice always leaves this evocative kind of note on our senses, doesn't it? A kind of an encounter.
Yeah, that's right. You remind me actually of a movie I saw many, many years ago called The Comfort of Strangers, which was set in Venice. And I can't remember who the actors and protagonists were at the moment, but I remember it was all set in this foggy, dark, dank, murky Venice. So it's so true what you're saying. There's the bright side of Venice and there's the dark side. And think of Thomas Mann and Death in Venice, you know, that another wonderful movie, I think it was Visconti, again, painting with a different shade, different palette, etc. But in any event, we're coming to the end of our chat. We're running out of time. And should we tell people where we're going to go next time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of naturally brings us to Ravenna, thinking about Murano earlier. So kind of look at the embodiment of the glass mosaic in Ravenna would be something I'd really enjoy.
Okay, well, until the next time, and we'll see you in a fortnight on Spotify, The Grand Tour. Thanks, Linda.
Arrivederci, Michael. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.